25 years after its first season aired, Friends remains incredibly popular. If it were counted in the Nielsen ratings as a new show, it would rank at number 9. Even after all this time, the Friends phenomenon continues to grow and evolve, attracting a new generation of younger fans who weren't even alive when the show premiered. For the 25th anniversary of the pilot episode, in his new book, Generation Friends, an inside look at the show that defined a television era, pop culture writer and NYU professor of writing and comedy history, Saul Austerlitz, shares a nostalgic, fascinating look at how the show was created, cast, and filmed, analyzing the best episodes, plot points, and themes, and provides insight into why the show that defined 1990s television has a popularity and legacy that has endured beyond anyone's wildest expectations. Again, the name of the book is Generation Friends, and it's a pleasure to welcome Saul Austerlitz to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what brought you to want to write about this particular show? Of course, the anniversary was coming up, but what was it about Friends that piqued your curiosity?
So a few years ago, I had written a book called Sitcom, which was a history of the American sitcom, and one of the chapters was about Friends. And I got to watch the show again and really enjoyed it, but sort of felt like I'd said my piece about it. And then a few years ago, I came across a story in the New York Times that was talking about how younger fans, high school students in New York City, had discovered the show and were watching it and talking about it and arguing about it and making it their own. And I came to realize that there was this entirely new generation of fans who were embracing the show and treating it as their own. And I was fascinated by that, which is, you know, it's such an unprecedented thing. Most shows have their fan base, have people who love the show, and then once it goes off the air, it's really just those initial fans who keep watching it. And so Friends' unusual distinction got me interested. And I wanted to tell the story of the show, both for the fans like myself who had watched it when it was first on, and also for these new fans who are discovering it afresh, and to tell the story of the fans themselves, to understand what it was about this show that kept them so captivated.
It seems as though you look at of why it would be popular today, and you would say, oh, well, there's the universal nature of friendship, which of course makes sense. But it seems like there's more to it than that, besides that it's still very funny. It holds up.
Yes, it really does. I think a big part of it is that it's the combination of comedy and a kind of soap operatic atmosphere. And I don't mean that in any kind of negative way. It's that, you know, yes, you have the jokes and the banter and the sitting around the coffee house and chatting, but you also have this emotional nuance and emotional content where we in the audience are interested and fascinated to find out, well, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen in these relationships? How will it all play out? And I think Friends is really savvy in the ways that it pulls the audience in with the sense of character and plot development and things constantly changing and shifting and developing.
It was 1994, and the first week in October, my wife and I were celebrating our honeymoon. We had just been married, and we went out to, we were driving the West Coast. We wound up in L.A., and we were going through the Universal Studios theme park, and a guy came up and said, would you like tickets to a TV show? Here were our choices, Saul. We had Sybil, which was a pilot. We had Coach, or we had Friends. As of that point in that first week in October, I had never heard of Friends. We went with Coach. 2 weeks later, we realized what a huge show Friends came out to be, which is a long way of saying this show had buzz from the very beginning for a cast of relative unknowns.
That's definitely true. You know, it was right at the time where Seinfeld had gone from being relatively under the radar to becoming a huge hit.
Right.
And so the search was really on at NBC and all the networks to look for shows that could kind of fill that same space. And so if you look at a lot of the reviews that emerged at the time, they're mostly pretty respectful. There are some outliers like Tom Shales at the Washington Post who really bashes the show, but they're all very much considering it as a kind of carbon copy of Seinfeld, which I think in retrospect is sort of fascinating because, you know, Seinfeld is a fantastic show, and it's a show that's entirely allergic to emotion. Their motto is no hugging, no learning. And what is Friends if not a show that's all about hugging and learning?
And I guess the only comparison can be made is the odd bonds of friendship and also the setting of New York.
Yeah, no, it is a show set in New York. It's a show about friends hanging out. It's a show about relationships, which Seinfeld also is to some extent. But the style of the show and the way it relates to the characters is notably quite different.
Much warmer as well. You like these people.
Exactly. And Seinfeld is intent on making you like their characters less and less as things go on, whereas Friends is really intent on having us feel that same bond of friendship with the characters as the characters are depicted having amongst themselves.
You write in the book that the original idea was basically Cheers on a coffee shop.
That's correct. Yeah. You know, that develops and changes over time. Initially, the thought had been that the character of Monica would be the mainstay of the show. She would be the main character, and the other characters would be in more supporting roles. And they had pictured Monica as being a kind of gruff, tough-talking, but ultimately lovable New Yorker and chef. And we're picturing and hoping to cast someone like Janine Garofalo in the role.
And then what happened? When did it become all for one, one for all, which obviously became even more important when salary negotiations came on many, many years later?
Yeah, so there were adaptations made over the course of writing the pilot and shooting the pilot. And part of that was initially the thought had been that Monica and Joey, that those characters would be the kind of main romantic plot line. And then once they had cast the show and seeing David Schwimmer and Jennifer Aniston and the way that they seemed to connect and the chemistry that they had, they realized that there was something there and decided to shift that aspect of the plot line to the characters of Rachel and Ross.
That relationship really became so central to the show and of Ross and Rachel. And you write in the book that it really put another relationship that was could have been in the mix earlier was that of Monica and Chandler.
Yeah, there was some discussion of it as early as the second season. It came up in the writer's room where they were discussing this thought of, well, what would happen if we brought Monica and Chandler together? And it was rejected, you know, that there was a fear amongst the writers that people in the audience would perceive this show as kind of unnaturally bringing these characters together in strange permutations. So it wasn't until a few seasons later when they realized they were going to have a season finale in London that they thought it might be a nice kind of comedic counterbalance to have Monica and Chandler end up in bed together. Mm. And the initial thought was that it was just going to be kind of one hilarious scene and that would be the end of it. And then writing it, they realized that there were other possibilities and there was the potential to build it out a bit more. And then seeing how enthusiastically the audience in London responded to these scenes, they decided that there was even more to it. They brought it back to New York and it just kind of slowly and relatively organically built from there into becoming a substantial relationship on the show in its own right.
Saul Austerlitz is our guest. The name of the new book is Generation Friends, an inside look at the show that defined a television era. From my memory, and even in the book, it doesn't seem like there was really a whole lot of negative press that came out of the set of that program, that it was a fairly calm environment. Is that fair to say?
That's my sense as well. It seems like the actors got along quite well with each other and by all accounts, were quite friendly. Really, the only negative press that comes out early on it has to do with the relative lack of diversity on the show. And there's a fair amount of media criticism, even at the time, you know, taking the show to account for having this all-white cast and not really, you know, having a depiction of New York that somehow seems to be only composed of white people.
And they didn't really seem to do much to counter that, did they?
It really takes quite some time for them to cast any non-white performers in major roles, and it does sometimes feel to me like it's a bit late in the game, you know, to wait 7 or 8 seasons to get to the point where there's anyone on the show who's not white.
The very cool thing about the show, I always have found as a great fan of it, I like it much more than Coach, actually, is that I still have my ticket for that show, my original Friends ticket from 1994. But when I look at what really attracts me is the running gags, the fact of Chandler talking about his odd upbringing and his father and his mother and the entire cast many seasons later making fun of Ross for how many times he's been married. These are things that are subtle, but they're also so real in any dynamic or any relationship that you would have with a group of people. And rare in television,
yeah,
I think.
Mm-hmm. And I think that they pull us in the audience as well, because in the same way that these group of fictional friends are bonding over these shared experiences or shared inside jokes, we're being included in that as well. And I think it gives us the feeling of kind of being a part of it in some fashion as well.
So this, in my reading of your book, pretty much this, the hit that they have on their hands is a surprise to just about everybody, correct? I mean, this thing became just a giant.
Yeah, I mean, everyone was hoping that it would be successful, but I don't think anyone went into this assuming, okay, this show is going to run for 10 seasons, is going to dominate the Nielsen ratings, and is going to become this unprecedented hit that people are still talking about 25 years later. I don't think that was on anyone's radar. I think the hope early on was, if things go really well, we'll be picked up and we can finish a first season. And then if things continue to be extremely good from there, maybe we'll be able to run for a couple of seasons and put something nice together.
You talk about the ending of the show. You have a chapter entitled Lightning in a Bottle, saying goodbye to the show. They all pretty much knew when the time was right for them to head off.
Yeah, you know, later in the show's run, there were a number of contract negotiations where each of the partners, you know, the creators of the show, the actors on the show, NBC and Warner Brothers all entered into this negotiation to see if it would go on. And each time there was a kind of different set of concerns that were brought to the table. But yeah, by the time we get to the 9th season and everyone signs on to do one more a year, it's fairly clear that at least some of the actors have, you know, had enough and want to move on to do something else. And even NBC, which is at this point paying top dollar so that it can have one more season of really superlative ratings, they also feel like that's about all that they can do. And David Crane and Marta Kaufman, what they said all along was, just give us advance notice of when the show is going to end so we can end it the way that we want to. But there was not a lot of pent up desire at that point to say, oh, let's go, you know, 5 more seasons after this.
A lot has been in the press recently, and a lot of it from your book too, about the fact that there's little or no chance that there will ever be a reboot or a reunion of any kind. That seems to be out of the question, which is a stance that they have maintained since the show went off the air.
Yeah, and, you know, at the time when they were pitching the show, they had this motto for the show that was, it's the time in your life when your friends are your family. And the point that the creators of the show come back to in kind of putting this idea to rest is to say that, you know, these characters that we know and love who are in their 20s and in their early 30s, well, they're in their 50s now, and it's a different time in their lives. And so the choices would either be to write a show about characters in their 50s, which would potentially be terrific, but probably wouldn't be Friends, or it would be to somehow shoehorn them into the familiar plot lines and storylines, which I think would be ultimately very awkward and unfulfilling. And the creators of Friends are very conscious of their legacy, of having created this show that people really love and care about. And the idea of doing damage to it or of creating something that doesn't stand up to what they have previously managed to accomplish is something that's, to, as far as I understand, you know, not appealing to them at all.
And yet they allowed Joey to exist, the follow-up to Friends.
Yeah, I think the hope had been that Joey was going to be a kind of Frasier to Friends Cheers, that it would be a show that would take one character and head off in a different direction, and yet kind of maintain some of the audience's connection and do its own thing. But I think that removing Joey to Los Angeles and surrounding him with this different cast of characters, including his family, it seemed to be a bridge too far for the audience, and they didn't really connect with it. Although that said, if you just look at the ratings for Joey, at least by 2019 standards, it was doing great. You know, you show any network executive those numbers for a new show, and they will gladly take it. But at the time, and obviously in a different television environment, it was considered to be a notable disappointment and didn't even last for two seasons.
I know this is somewhat arcane, but I found it to be fascinating in the book that Kevin Bright, who was one of the original creators, who goes and is the guy behind Joey, this pretty much just kills television for him altogether. I mean, his life just falls apart after this.
Yeah, and I think I was really appreciative that he was willing to talk so honestly with me about his experiences. And I think part of it was acknowledging that television is just a really tough business, and it's tough on your personal life. So that obviously having a show like Friends is a remarkable thing to happen to your career, but it also means that you work 70 or 80 hour weeks for a decade. And, you know, you kind of miss out on your family's life for a decade. And I think that took a real toll. And it gave me more insight into how hard it is to be on in the world of television. I think we often think about it as a matter of, is my show a success or is it not a success? And that's obviously part of it. But even having a show that's a big success can take a real toll as well.
What do you think it says, and I read this in the beginning, in the introduction, about Friends being ranking number 9 if it were in the Nielsen's today, because so many people are still watching it. I watched several episodes last night on Netflix. It was just announced that it was going to be leaving for Warner Media's HBO Max in 2020. A lot of money behind that deal. And I guess just what does that say about what's currently on television that we still, at least for people like us who saw the original show, still want it around in our lives?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's a completely different television environment from the one that was familiar in the 1990s. In the 90s, there were four networks, one of which was sort of a junior network, and cable already existed, but the amount of original programming was very minimal. Whereas now we have something like 500 scripted shows on television this year. So, you know, part of it is that Friends is really the last of the network television giants, you know, the product of an era where people all pretty much watched the same thing at the same time. And there was this sense of, oh, I got to watch this because everyone will be talking about it tomorrow. And even shows that occupy something of a similar space today, like something like Game of Thrones, you know, it's just, it attracts a much smaller audience. But I do think that part of the appeal of the show is that kind of aiming for the broad middle that Friends does, that it's a show that is about friendship and that makes us feel a kind of kinship in it, in our own way, to the characters. And I think especially for younger audiences, there's this sense of watching the show and seeing it as a kind of roadmap to the future to see, okay, well, what's my life going to be like? What do I have to look forward to when I'm in my 20s, whether it's, you know, first relationships, first jobs, first heartache, maybe eventually getting married and having children. And so I think that presenting all of that and putting it in this context of, well, I'm going to do all these things, but I'm also going to do them always and forever with my friends, I think that's a really appealing fantasy for a certain swath of the audience.
the book is endlessly fascinating and very sweet and really a lot of fun. Generation Friends, an inside look at the show that defined a television era. It is published by Dutton. Saul Austerlitz, thanks so much for joining us. Great pleasure having you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Generation Friends, an inside look at the show that defined a television era. Saul Austerlitz is the author. It's published by Dutton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Smelly cat, what are they feeding you? Smelly cat, it's not your fault.